You remind me if I forget. Because I hear a lot of feedback. It sounds very interesting. I was so interested in what Amy Clampett said about all women poets feeling influenced by Emily Dickinson. I have to enter a little demurrer. There must be something wrong with me because I have never felt the way. Her poems were ruined for me. Well, I think, really, high school teachers have a lot to answer for, and one of the things they do is that they give you the worst poems. Women wrote 1,700 poems or something, and they managed to find the three that are really saccharine and sententious. There is no frigate like book. Children read more books. And the one I really hated as a young infidel, I never saw more, I never saw the sea, and goes on to say, I know these things exist, and therefore I know God exists too. I thought, what are you talking about? Anyway, so I'm very grateful to Seton Hall, because if it hadn't been for Seton Hall, I never would have sat down and gotten to have a different relationship with Emily Dickinson, who, of course, is a wonderful poet and great genius, and I find her a very interesting person. I was looking at that biography by Richard Sewell, and he has a whole appendix of popular poetry that was being published while Emily Dickinson, as you know, was having such a terrible time. I think Emily Dickinson had the worst taste in men that I've just ever seen, and she would pick these people to be her mentors who were very inappropriate figures who would all say, oh, don't push, this is all very strange. But they would kind of string her along by being very nice to her, and she would have these elaborate correspondences with them. And I found this just so depressing. One of these people was Samuel Bowles, who was one of the candidates for the famous Master of Letters, and who she does seem to have had very warm feelings for. And he published a couple of her poems, but she sent him the things by the bushel. And meanwhile, while he was refusing to publish her, he published a poem that was so much loved by its readers that they had to print it twice. And this was by Miss Nancy A.W. Priest, Hinsdale, New Hampshire. And I think it's interesting to see what Emily Dickinson is doing against the background of what her neighbors were doing, though it seems much more successful. And I'll just read you the first verse. It's called Over the River. Over the river they beckon to me, loved ones who've crossed to the further side. The gleam of their snowy robes I see, but their voices drowned in rush tide. There's one with ringlets sunny gold, and eyes reflection of heaven's own blue. He crossed in twilight gray and cold, and the pale mist hid him from mortal view. We saw not the angels who met there, the gate of the city we could not see. Over the river, my brother stands waiting to welcome, and so on. Well, the thing that is really amazing, and Richard Sewell, who has written this, 800-page biography, just sort of falls to his knees in the mystery of this, is he says one of the mysteries of Emily Dickinson, from our point of view, is how she could enjoy such stuff and yet write the way, because the fact was Emily Dickinson really liked these things. At the same time as she's reading Shakespeare and the Bible and having a very serious relationship with literature, including much of the contemporary literature of her own time, she would read the Springfield Republican and think, oh, I really like that. I just don't understand this at all. I thought it would be interesting to see two of her poems of death, which, was a big subject for her and for a lot of contemporaries, against the background of this kind of poetry. This was one that the Springfield Republican did publish, although in a sort of conventionalized form. They gave it a title, they fixed up the situation, they changed some of the language too. And it's called Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, sleep the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof stone. Grand go the years in the crest above them, worlds scoop their arc, firmament row, diadem drop, doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. It wasn't that Thomas Hardy could have written that poem if Emily Dickinson hadn't written it. And then here's another one, which is about another very popular 19th century subject, which is watching at a deathbed, except Emily Dickinson gives it an odd twist. The last night that she lived, it was a common night, except the dying. This, to us, made nature different. We noticed smallest things, things overlooked for, by this great light upon our minds, italicized her. That others could exist, well, she must finish quite. jealousy for her arose so nearly infinite. We waited while she passed. It was a narrow time. Too jostled were our souls speak. At length the note came. She mentioned and forgot. Then lightly as reed bent to the water, shivered scarce, consented, and said. And we placed hair and drew the head erect. And then an awful leisure was our faith regulate. I think the way that last line is so wonderful, regulate, is not the word's effect there. It's really great. I'm going to read a couple of poems from my only book, and then I'll read some new poems. The first poem I'll read is called Archaeology, and it has an epigraph from my friend Jonathan Laffey, with whom I had a conversation about to what extent is poetry or one's subject and the way you write determined by your character, and to what extent is it the mysterious workings of the imagination. He held out for the former, I for the latter, and I've since decided he was probably right. And it's called Archaeology. Our real poems are already in us, and all we could do is dig, Jonathan Laffey. You knew the odd failure start. That morning you first saw or thought you saw beneath the heat-struck plains of a second-rate country, the outline of buried cities. 1,000 to 1, you'd turn up nothing more than rubbish heap, poor near eastern backwater, a few chipped beads, splinters of glass pottery, broken tablets whose secret... Oh, gracious, what happened here? Hello? Emily Dickinson didn't have you.
Should I just continue reading and be loud?
Can you hear me if I... Oh, aha. Lord. Maybe I'll start. Okay. Archaeology. You knew the odds on failure from start. That morning you first saw or thought you saw beneath the heat-struck plains of a second-rate country, the outline buried cities. 1,000 to 1, you'd turn up nothing more than the rubbish heap of poor near eastern backwater, a few chipped beads, splinters of glass pottery, broken tablets whose secret lore, laboriously deciphered, would prove to be only a collection of ancient grocery lists. Still, the train moved away from the station without you. How many lives ago was that? How many choices? Now that you've got your bushel full of shards, do you say, give me back my years, or wrap yourself in the distant glitter of desert stars, telling yourself it was foolish, after all, to have dreamed of uncovering some fluent vessel, the bronze head of a god? Pack up your fragments. Let the simoom flatten the... Now come the passionate midnight, the museum basement. When out of that random rubble, you'll invent the death market smelling of sheep and spices, street, palmy gardens, courtyards set with wells, to which, in the blue of evening, one by one, come strong, veiled women bearing their perfect jars. The next poem I'll read is called The Dancers. One poet who I've thought a lot more about than I have about Emily Dickinson until now is T.S. Eliot, because I really can't stand him. And I like something about him. I think, you know, he wrote really, he has a vein of beautiful melancholy despair that appeals to me very much. But I hate all his ideas profoundly. And I think all this very reactionary politics and this real assumption that the life we all live in the 20th century of a great deal of, what do you want to say, different peoples all mingling together in a very polyglot way is a very bad thing, and that we should all go back to pure traditions in which, I must say, I wouldn't have much part, according to him, as a Jewish person. So, naturally, I don't like that. And so I wrote this. It takes off first lines with little references to some of his little anti-Semitic and other characters. And it's called The Dancers. So what if Sweeney buys drinks for Rachel Rabinowitz or Aunt Helen Footman Danville's second parlor maid? At the rank-and-file Greek fur workers' dinner at Dante Caterer's in Astoria last night, the floor was covered with iridescent vinyl, and the chandeliers were plastic, and everyone spoke bad English and said, what a beautiful party. Well, to the electrified mandolins of Athanasius and his ethno-rhythmics, the heavy-breasted, lacquered, and mascaraed women, arose in their nylon dresses of chemical turquoise, orange, and shocking pink, and danced with their dapper husbands the foxtrot, the rumba, and the lovely dances of Sparta, and did not profane them. So, anyway, I don't usually write poems that have very much to do with politics, but that was one, and here's another. Another person I really dislike is Carl Jung. And I really hate this sort of way of dividing things besides men and women into male and female, and seeing particular symbols. You know, the moon is female, the sun is masculine, all this animus stuff. I really think that is not an interesting way to see either people or things that are not people. So in this poem, I propose that we just drop all that and think of some other things to say. And it's called Metaphors of Women. What if the moon was never a beautiful moon? Call it a shark fearing across black water, an ear, a drum in a desert, a window, a bone shoe. What if the sea was discovered to have no womb? Let it be cloud, blue as the day they were born, a ceremony bell question, a toothache, a lost twin. What if the woman is not the moon sea? Say, map of the air, say, green parabola, lichen and the stone that feeds it. No rain, rain. And then I'd like to read the title poem from my book, which is called To an Antarctic Traveler, which I wrote for my friend Catherine Boughton, who is a reporter and very intrepid. She went to Antarctica, a place I had always wanted to go to, but she's very brave, and so she got to go. And so I wrote this. All the things that I represent as happening to her really did. She really did have a mountain, and she's on the map of the world. I just find this so amazing. And I thought to myself, God, that thing, you know? So... Anyway, To an Antarctic Traveler. It's in two parts. When you return from the country of refusal, what will you think of us? Down there, no, final. It had a glamour. So Pavlova turned, Narcissus pale and utterly self-consumed from the clack, the hothouse roses. So the ice perfects its own reflection, cold Versailles, and does not want you, does not want even Scott, grinding him out of graves. Splash, off he goes, into the ocean, comical Edwardian, a valentine thrown out. Afternoons in the pastry shop, coffee and macaroons, gossip, two-part intricate inventions, meshed in the sugary air like the down and across of an endless Sunday puzzle. What will such small temporizations mean to you now you've traveled half the world and seen the ego glinting the heart of things? Oh, I'm not worried. I know you'll come back full of adventures, anecdotes, penguins, and the pilot who let you fly the cargo. But you'll never be wholly ours, as a green glass bottle mouthed and rolled, dragged by the sea, until it forgets life entirely, wine, flowers, candles. The castaways save me, meticulously printed in 11 languages, and now it rests, a beach house mantle, opalescent, dumb. You'll stand at the cocktail party, among the beige plush furniture and abstract, and listen politely, puzzled. A foreigner anxious to respect our customs, but not quite sure of the local dialect, while guests hold forth on their love travel. And all the time you hear the waves beat on that shore for a million years. Go away, go away, go away. And the hostess fills your glass and offers crackers. They named a mountain after there, blank and shining, unclimbable, no different from 100 nameless others. It did not change as you called to it from the helicopter. It was your name that, spinning away from you, round and round, and as children repeat a word endlessly, until at last it comes up, pure nonsense, hilarious. It smashed and lay, a shattered mirror, smiling meaninglessly up at you from the unmarked snow. More lasting than bronze, the monument raised, boasted Horace, not actually, and yet what else you have to think, or you? That day you wrote yourself on the world itself. And as the pilot veered away forever, saw mist drift over your mountain almost immediately. And your name stayed behind, a testament source, a proof of something, though only in the end, white chalk invisibly scribbled on a white tabula rasa. So. Okay, fine. I thought I would read that poem that or introduced or mentioned Lives of the 19th Century Poetesses. I should explain, you know, I wasn't thinking of Emily Dickinson when I wrote this because I was thinking of women poets. I hate that word feminism. Use of it was sort of supposed to be a tip-off. These are women who would have maybe thought of the way, not very good writers, much more conventional people than Emily Dickinson was, but who had something, had things that was very hard for them to express, given that things were the way they were. Lives of the 19th Century Poetesses. As girls, they were awkward and peculiar, wept in church, or refused to go at all. Their mothers saw right away no man would marry them. So they must live at the sufferance of others, timid and queer, governesses out of Chekhov, malnourished on theology, boiled eggs and tea, but given to outbursts of pride, embarrass everyone. After the final quarrel, the grand renunciation, they retire upstairs to the attic or to the small room in the cheap off-season hotel and write, "Today I burned all your letters," or "I dreamed the magnolia blazed like avenging angel, and when I woke, I knew I was hell." No one is prized when they die young, having left all their savings to a wastrel nephew, to be remembered for a handful of minor but perfect lyrics, a passion for jam or charades, and a letter still preserved in the family archive. I send you herewith the papers of your aunt who died last Tuesday in the odor of sanctity, although a little troubled in her mind by her habit, much disapproved of by the ignorant, of writing down the secrets of her heart. To write rather a lot of poems that are about poetry in one way or another. And this one is about the unhappier side of one's relationship to poems, the poems that don't work out. It's called Abandoned Poems. It's awful how they look at you, consumptive, all eyes in their white beds, coughing delicately into their handkerchiefs and feebly hissing, "Don't leave us here, you bastard. This is your fault. What can you do but agree? It's no use to harden your heart, no use to explain why you had to save yourself, still less to confess how happy you are without them. How already you see yourself under the trees in the park, you read paper, you eat a ham sandwich, then shake out the crumbs for the pigeons and walk on, savoring the mild autumnal air of your new country, the kingdom of health and silence." And this next poem is called A Walk. Maybe not the best title I've ever thought of, but I couldn't do any better. And this is the sort of takes off from the Chinese poets, who are so wonderful because complain some. I like that. When I go for a walk, see they're tearing down some old red plush Rialto, an off building, and suddenly realize this was where Mama and I saw Lovers of Teruel three times in a single sitting. And the drugstore where we went afterwards for ice cream gone too, and Mama's gone, and my 10-year-old self. I admire more than ever the ancient Chinese poets who were comforted in exile by thought of the transient life. How yesterday, for instance, quince bloomed in the emperor's courtyard, but today wild geese fly south over ruined towers. Or, "Oh, full moon that shone on our scholarly wine parties, do you see us now scattered on distant shores? A melancholy restraint is surely the proper approach to this world. And so I walk on, recalling Sun Shi, who when old and full of sadness, wrote merely, 'Cool day, a fine fall.'" This next poem is called The White Room. I think a lot of people have fantasies of being recluses or totally solitary, and this is about one of those fantasies. "Possible to believe in a bearable sort of life, in a white room, in one of the tidy, anonymous streets that flash by the elevated subway. Picture it, a blue chair for reading, a gas ring for coffee, the lamp in a cheap shade, half a circle of light. Outside, foot sits down on the cornflowers in the vacant lot. The tailor goes down to the corner for paper. The sandwich man stands in his doorway listening to the Saturday opera on the radio. You pass and exchange grave nods with your neighbors, fellow anchorites, proud in your way to have chosen for discipline the solitude you tell yourself you probably would have come to anyway." And I want to read a poem called Epithalamion, which is a hymn for a marriage or a poem for a marriage. This poem is, what I like about it is it's Sapphic, not a meter, Epithalamion. And it's for the wedding of two friends. The boy who scribbled Smash the State in icing, his wedding cake, has two kids and a co-op. Reads, although pretends not to, the living section, and hopes for tenure. Everything's changed. We played capture the red flag between Harvard Yard and the river. Which of us dreamed that history, who grinds men up like meat, would make us her next meal? But here we are, kind of post-imperial, permanent February, with offices and apartments, balk latecomers out of a Stendhal novel, our brave ambitions run out of sand, into restaurants and movies. July at the Cape, where the major source of amusement, watching middle-aged Freudians, snub only just younger Marxist historians. And yet, if it's true, as I've read, that starving body eats itself, it's true, too, it eats the heart last. We've lost grandeur, but come on, admit it, aren't we happier? And so, let's welcome the child already beginning, who'll laugh, but not cruelly, I hope, at our comfy nostalgias. And praise friends, praise marriage, friends, and lovers, made in a dark time. That's another political poem, too, come to think of it. See, I've run out of time, so I'll read one more poem. This is a poem called Atlantis. You all know that myth. I won't go through it. Dreaming of our golden boulevard temples, our painted palace set in torchlit gardens, our spires and minarets, our emerald harbor. You won't want to hear about city we knew. The narrow neighborhoods, low white houses where workmen come for lunch and an afternoon nap. Old women in sweat-stained penitential black ease their backaches gratefully against doorways. And the widow who keeps the corner grocery anxiously watches her child dragging his toy, who was sickly from birth and everyone knows must die soon. You won't want to know how we live. The hot sun, the horse trader cheating each other out of boredom. In the brothel, the prostitute curling each other's hair while the madam limps upstairs, feeds canaries. The young lout smoke at bare cafes where old men play dominoes for a glass of cognac. And how can we blame you? We too were in love with something we never could name. We never could let ourselves say that the way the harbor flashed like bronze at sunset or the hill town swam in the twilight like green stars were only trick the light meant nothing. We too believed that a moment would surely come when our lives would stand hard and pure like marble statues. And because we were, after all, only a poor city, a city like others, of sailors, bars, sunflowers, we gave ourselves up to be only a name, an image, temples, spires, and jeweled gardens, for which reason we are envied of all people, and even now could not say what life would have to be for us to have chosen it. Thank you.